This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Fall and school is back in session, a time when all high school juniors and seniors should be thinking about football, the prom, and applying for college. That last item is a doozy. It can throw students and parents for a loop. It's a daunting and sometimes complicated task, and one on which a lot is riding. There are so many decisions to make and deadlines to meet, and aside from doing research on schools, making applications, writing essays, visiting schools, finding the money to attend, students also have to figure out how to make themselves stand out from the rest of the crowd. A little expert advice might be helpful. A little expert advice is mandatory, and we've got three experts in our studio this hour. Lee Bearer has been here before because for years she has been writing a nationally syndicated column, the Countdown to College column, distributed by Tribune News Service. She's also an independent college counselor and president of College Admissions Strategies. Welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me.
And Dr. Andrew Belasco is CEO and co-founder of College Transitions and also the co-author with Dave Bergman of The Enlightened College Applicant, a new approach to the search and admissions process. Welcome to you.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
And Dr. Michael Trivette is the other co-founder of College Transitions, an independent college admission consulting company. Welcome to you.
Thank you.
And this is back to your old stomping grounds because you were a sports broadcaster before.
That's right. So back in old familiar territory.
In another life, yeah. A long time ago.
Well, that's right.
Dude, this whole process of getting ready for applying to college, I remember it as being really straightforward and very simple. And now it's become so complicated that an industry of consultants has sprung up. Is that also why it's complicated? Because an industry of consultants has now sprung up to take advantage of what used to be between you, your parents, and your high school counselor?
I think it's also because it's become a more increasingly complex process. There are a lot more moving parts in the admissions process now.
Why?
Well, it's just become more of a competitive game. There are a lot of students out there who are looking to get into very competitive schools, and as a result, there are a lot of institutions who have, I guess, come up with additional admission requirements. So now there's subject tests that students might have to take.
So, Lee, back in the Pleistocene age when I went to school, were there fewer students wanting to go to school? The baby boom generation was a big generation. Were there fewer people wanting to go to college?
There are multiple factors that relate to the increase in competitiveness. And I think one of them is the fact that students are applying to more colleges. And so that the students are completing more applications, which means more work. And because students are applying to more schools, colleges are not really sure who's going to actually accept their offers.
And they're applying to more schools. Why? To hedge their bets? to make sure they get into something? Because there are a lot of people competing to get in. Why?
Yeah, I think that's part of it. I also think for many of them, they're waiting to see about the financial aid situation and whether they get more money from one school versus another school.
Andrew and Michael, according to your company, and I think I got this off your website, College Transitions, aside from purchasing a home, a college education represents the largest investment that you will make during your life. And with all this talk we've been hearing about college debt, the mountains of college debt, that would obviously testify to the veracity of that statement. Does that mean that any serious prospective college student should employ the services of somebody like you or Lee because it's that important?
Well, I don't think it depends on what the family's needs are. You know, if they're looking, they want to kind of expand their reach and look at schools all across the country. They might not be as familiar with the admissions process as certain public and private institutions on the West Coast. They're looking for some expert advice. You know, maybe that's where we come in. If they're looking, you know, to stay locally here at maybe a public college, 2-year or 4-year institution, you know, there may not be the need for us. So it kind of depends on what the family really wants to obtain and what that student's goals are.
And that's why you've written this book, The Enlightened College Applicant. That's why you write these weekly columns that appear in papers across the country, because people could do it themselves if they study up.
Absolutely. I mean, there's a lot They can do. I hear from grandparents all the time, I've been clipping your columns. I have a book. I send them to my kids every weekend. So families can do a lot on their own, but there are definitely nuances in the process that I think professionals are really aware of, and trends in college admissions that impact it each year.
So as Andrew said at the very beginning of the program, it's become a lot more complex, the process of applying. There are lots of people applying. There are thousands of schools. Where do you start?
Well, it's important, you know, you have to look at fit, obviously. So things like location, environment, the vibe of the campus are really important. But there are also some hard indicators, some actual outcomes that students also need to be looking to when making their college decision. So, you know, these can include whether schools have strengths in your area of interest, academic interest, career and graduate school replacement, placement rates, the size and activity of an institution's alumni network, affordability. You know, does the school have a record of providing adequate need-based financial aid? Do they provide merit-based aid? Now, a lot of these indicators, you know, are available to students, information, but students have to take the time to look. They have to go beyond the college guidebooks.
And do you start when you're a junior, a rising junior?
Start probably, yeah, I would say even a little bit earlier than that.
So I'm a rising, I'm a falling sophomore in high school. And I know that this decision is going to be upon me in the next 2.5 years.
Yeah.
Where do I begin? What's the first thing that I should think about or do? What should I be doing? Should it be making sure that I'm participating in certain extracurricular activities? Should it be making sure that my GPA is the best it can be? Should it be actually going through catalogs online or wherever, paper catalogs, looking at schools? What should it be?
All of the above, right? You know, it's a concurrent process. So it's exploring the options that are out there, but it's also making sure that your resume is going to be impactful and full of different kinds of activities, leadership and extracurricular activities, community service. And there's no question that the most important piece of the application is going to be the students' rigor of their curriculum and their performance in their classes.
Now, here's how dumb I was. It never occurred to me when I was a young person looking at colleges that it mattered where you went. I have since discovered that if you're lucky enough to go to Harvard or Princeton, you're probably going to do pretty well. So does it matter that you get into the best school or the one that's right for you?
According to research, prestige does matter, but only to a certain extent. So there are a lot of rigorous studies out there that have actually shown that you should go to a good school, but it's not necessarily you go to the most elite school. Go to a school that's sufficiently competitive. So, for example, if you have the opportunity to go to Yale or UNC Chapel Hill, which is also a very competitive school, you don't necessarily need to choose Yale. In fact, outcomes related to your job, your graduate school placement will likely have more to do with what you do while there than where you go. But if the option, the choice is between UNC Chapel Hill and a school like Campbell University, for instance, which is another North Carolina college, but much less selective, you should probably go to UNC Chapel Hill, because what this research says is that schools like UNC Chapel Hill, schools in the Ivy League, have the requisite resources, networks, brand to get students to where they need to be.
And if you plan to stay in North Carolina, going to UNC Chapel Hill or Duke,
that's right.
It gives you an automatic network of people.
Absolutely.
When you get out of school.
Yeah.
That's important, and that's something no one ever told me about either.
Yeah.
So because things are important other than academics, extracurricular activities, things outside of school that you might do with your church or in the community, since that has become so important, why are these non-academic pursuits important? Why?
Well, because they do look great for your college applications, but also colleges are wanting to recruit a diverse group of students from various backgrounds. And so,
why do they want to do that?
They're trying to build a community, essentially, on that college campus. So you want people who represent different viewpoints, different backgrounds on that campus. And so your activities can kind of speak to that. So, you know, we tell students all the time, you know, when looking to get involved, pick the things that you're truly most passionate about, the two or three activities that you really can see yourself wanting to do, not only in high school, but maybe also on a college campus, because those are going to be the things that are important to you outside of the classroom.
And you shouldn't wait, should you? I mean, if you're a junior and you're now beginning the process and you have done nothing, you haven't participated in the drama club or sports or the marching band or anything like that, and you haven't done anything out in the community, is it too late to flesh out that part of your college-bound resume?
It's not too late, but you don't want to wait a whole lot longer, right? Because most students are completing their applications the summer before senior year or certainly in the fall of the senior year, which means that what you do as a senior is not particularly relevant to your college applications. Because so for the most part, it's really what have you done through your junior year that is relevant to the college application.
And it also depends on where you apply as well. There are a lot of larger schools out there that employ much more formula-driven processes. So if I'm applying to Davidson College right outside here in Charlotte, they're going to adopt a more holistic approach to the admissions process. They're going to be looking more closely at your extracurricular profile. That is different than a place like NC State, you know, or the University of Georgia or UNC Chapel Hill, where extracurricular activities do matter. But because so many applications are coming across the desks of admissions officers at these institutions, things like grades and standardized test scores really play a paramount role in the process. Not that they don't do at Davidson, but again, Davidson has the luxury and the time to look at those activities more closely.
So where these activities, these extracurricular activities, count,
sure,
where they count, which ones seem to be the most important?
It's not so much about the type of activity, it is your quality of involvement. So what we tell our students, as Mike just said earlier, is that choose things that you're passionate about. If you don't like sports, don't play sports. You know, if you don't like editing for the newspaper, don't do that. Choose something, whether it's school-affiliated or outside of school, that you could really enjoy, really
like.
But
there are a lot of kids who are just floating in the world. They don't know what they want to do. They don't know what their major might be if they go to college.
Sure.
They haven't really found their niche in the world. What do you tell those kids? Because there are a lot of them.
Well, we tell students who contact us early in the process, you know, spend the first couple years of high school experimenting, looking around at things you're involved in. If you want to get on an athletic team and play football, try that out. Does it work for you? If not, does the robotic club offer you something that football can't? And so we tell students, spend some time, you know, pursuing your passions, things you're truly passionate about. And then, like Andrew said, spend that, you know, junior and senior year, if possible, to really dive deeply inside of those things, because that's going to come out in your college application, whether it be an essay and you're writing about a certain topic or a certain prompt that a college has, recommendations where teachers, professors, club advisors, employers are writing about, you know, what your involvement has been. So that's going to come out in other pieces of the application later down the road.
A long time ago, somebody said, do what you love, pursue what you love, because the money will come. That's turned out not to be true for a lot of people. The new business mantra is, don't do what you love, do what makes money, do what you love as a hobby. And given the cost of college, is now the time to make that decision in a young person's life? Yeah, I'd love this, but it's not going to pay anything, and it's going to cost $35,000 a year to go to college to study that. Maybe I should do something that's going to recoup that investment. Should that enter into the consideration?
I think and $35,000 is on the modest side for most. Okay, so you're
really?
Typically – so, you know, generally you break colleges into three areas, you're typically talking about in-state tuitions being generally between $15,000 and $25,000. Your out-of-state publics, that would be you, Georgia, Virginia Tech, et cetera, or you, Maryland, generally are coming in somewhere with $25,000 as high as $50,000 a year for Michigan and the University of California, the Californias. And then you've got your privates that are going to range generally from $40,000 to $65,000 a year, and some are even topping that.
So in 20 seconds, should you forsake your passion if it's not going to pay you anything and study something else? Quickly.
Yes.
Oh, my God. That was not the answer I was expecting. We'll come back and get more in a moment. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Doctors Making House Calls, serving patients in their home or workplace. All insurance accepted. Registration information available at doctorsmakinghousecalls.com. Never wait in a doctor's office. again. On the local news roundup tomorrow, the U.S. Supreme Court refuses to reinstate North Carolina's voter ID law. Some bumps in the road for CMS and their buses. We talk about some of the challenges the system faces. More details are emerging in the shooting of a deaf motorist by the Highway Patrol. And Donald Trump and Richard Burr have narrow leads in a new state poll. Our roundtable of reporters fills us in on those stories and many more tomorrow on this program during the local news roundup at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, Donald Trump lays out a plan for immigration after a meeting with the president of Mexico. An update on the Republican presidential nominee's proposals on immigration, illegal drugs, and trade.
Join the Diane Rehm Show following Charlotte Talks from 10 to noon on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about getting ready for applying to college, and we'll go through a lot of stuff that as much as we can get done here. But Lee Bearer, independent college counselor and president of College Admission Strategies, and also the writer of the weekly syndicated column Countdown to College. Doctors Andrew Belasco and Michael Trivette, or Trivett, are both co-founders of College Transitions, and Dr. Belasco, these two guys are too young to be doctors. He's the co-author of The Enlightened College Applicant. I was astounded to hear you say just before the break, Lee Bearer, that given the cost of college today, that if you have a passion, like theater, if it's going to cost you $40,000 a year and you're likely going to be a waiter or a waitress for some time and maybe the rest of your life, don't pursue that as a passion. Pursue something else. Have a fallback? Is that what you're saying?
I think with the cost of college, there needs to be some sense of what am I going to do with this degree. And so, yes, I still think students should follow their passion and they should take the courses they want to take, but they also need to think about earning a living once they graduate.
Okay, so it's fall. School started in Mecklenburg County last week. I'm a rising high school junior. What should I be doing right now?
Focusing on your grades and your standardized test scores first and foremost. Don't let anybody fool you. Those things are top priority in the admissions process. So junior year is perhaps the most important year in a student's high school career.
And the hardest, I think.
And the hardest, yeah. Yeah. So they need to be thinking about the rigor of their courses, looking for teachers that they might be able to ask a recommendation from, studying for those standardized tests. Standardized tests are preparing for them is such a great investment of time, not only because good scores can improve your prospects of admission, they can also improve your prospects of receiving financial aid. A boost of 2 to 3 points on an ACT can land you $10,000 to $20,000 extra per year during college. So, yes, there are a lot of test optional schools that are springing up, but at the overwhelming majority of schools, tests still
But those tests,
matter.
Like the SAT and the
yeah.
ACT, of which I took many of them, aren't they kind of a crapshoot? I mean, you can study, but really, can you study for those tests?
You can. You can. And that's why there's a billion-dollar industry, billions-dollar industry popping up around that.
According to collegeboard.org, in September, students should choose their colleges, find out about application deadlines, including financial aid, and start looking for scholarships. Do you all agree with that?
Yes.
Is that for juniors or for seniors or both?
It sounds like it's – if they're starting their applications, that it's for seniors.
Okay. If you're a rising high school senior, and it's today – what should you be doing? Something different than the juniors?
Yes. I think you need to be finalizing that list of prospective colleges so that you can delve deeply into the application process. A lot of the students, for instance, that Michael and I are working with right now have already begun their applications, begun their essays.
Should the first major consideration be what you want to major in, if you know what you want to major in, and many people don't? Or should it be finding a school that's the right fit for you? Or should it be the school that you can afford?
All of the above.
All of the above, absolutely. Yeah. And so most of our students, we've, and I'm sure Lee would say the same thing, we've been doing this for a long time already. So like Andrew mentioned, that list is usually finalized going late into the summer, early fall. That way, the Common App, which has already gone live, it went live August 1, students can start the application, they can start applying to schools. September 1 is here now today, so University of Georgia application is going live today. A lot of public university applications will go live this month. So students need to have already started the application process. We don't want to get to the point where we're waiting until October and November to start the applications, because many of those first early deadlines will be approaching. I mean, October 15th, that's UNC Chapel Hill's early action deadline, which is their first application deadline. So to put your best foot forward on each college application, you really need to start that process early in the semester.
What's a good GPA? Does it have to be a 4.0?
Depends less on the GPA and more on your class rank, how you're performing relative to other students within your high school. So GPAs are...
And that goes to the college with your transcript?
Yes, yes. But your colleges are more interested, again, in your relative performance. So there are schools that use a numerical scale on a 100-point scale. There are schools that use a 4.0 scale. So what a college, in effect, a lot of times does is recalculate that GPA, looks at your class rank, if you have one, how you rank relative to other students, or if you don't, if your school does not provide a class rank, again, look at your actual grades, your courses, and look at some of the other students that have applied in the past.
If you don't have a great GPA and you're a junior, is it too late to do something about it?
It's not too late to do something about it, but you might want to not apply early action, and you might want to hold off and apply regular decision, which is typically a January deadline or perhaps even later, so that colleges can see this fabulous new you first semester senior year with new grades and additional information.
Can a poor GPA be redeemed by a good SAT or ACT score?
It can at some schools.
Yeah.
It can at some schools.
Can it be redeemed by what you say in your application, on your essay, for instance?
It can be at some schools.
Certainly.
Some schools.
And there may be extenuating circumstances for why a student's GPA may be poor. You know, there may have been a certain incident in that student's life in the high school career that caused the GPA to suffer.
How important are the courses that you actually take in high school?
Critical.
Very critical. That's right, Lee. Yeah. I mean, so one of the top three factors in the admissions process is the difficulty level of your courses. So it's not just enough to get good grades. You have to get good grades in challenging courses,
so college prep courses. As many AP courses as you can get into?
As many APs as you can take and have solid performance. So a student who presents with straight A's but has never taken an honors class or an AP class is absolutely not going to be perceived as well as a student who took honors and APs and got a sprinkling of B's.
What if you don't know what your major, what you want your major to be? How does that look to a prospective college? Because you've just said that they want to build a community, a diverse community, but they also want people who are going to do well in their coursework so that they can produce outstanding graduates themselves. So if you don't know who what you want to be or where you want to major, how do you look to Duke or UNC Chapel Hill or somebody like that?
Some schools are more accepting of that than others. If you do apply to a university with distinct schools, distinct major offerings, they do want to see some type of general direction. However, if you're applying to a school like Davidson or other liberal arts schools like Guilford College in Greensboro, for example, they're okay with that because that is what a liberal arts education is about, using those first 2 years to explore a variety of different subjects, building a foundation, not in content, but in the skills that you need.
One of you, maybe both of you gentlemen, have worked as in admissions offices. Is that correct? Was it you,
both,
Michael?
Both of us have, okay. Yeah. I've worked on the admissions side, but Andrew's also worked in admissions doing alumni interviews, things like that as
That's
well.
That's at Georgetown?
Mm-hmm. That's correct.
So you know what colleges are looking for in prospective students. What are they looking for?
So, as we mentioned before, first and foremost, grades and standardized test scores, you need to be in the ballpark academically. If you're not in the ballpark academically, they are not going to be referring to those other things.
So you won't even get to the interview
point. Right. Well, you'll get offered an interview, but it won't really matter much, to be quite honest. If you are in the ballpark academically, then they're looking towards other things. Extracurricular profile. Demonstrated interest is a really important thing. Doing things to get schools to know that you are seriously considering them. That's very important because so many students are applying to so many schools today. Colleges are having a very difficult time predicting who's going to
roll. Should you have a ready answer, like in an interview situation, why do you want to come here? Should there be a ready answer?
Yes, there definitely should be, and it needs to be specific. It can't just be because this campus is beautiful, or I want to be in Charlotte, or
look good in blue. Yeah.
That's right.
Right.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah. Absolutely right.
Yeah,
that's right.
Which shade of blue?
Right. No, but we tell students all the time: if you're going to interview, find the program that you're really interested in that campus. Is there a certain faculty member that's doing certain types of research that really motivate you?
Your homework.
Inspire you? Yeah.
Is there a way to find out what they want to hear from you? What they want from you, either in the essay, the interview, or just on your application? Can you do some research to find out what that school wants?
Sure. You can go into a college's website. Many of these colleges will actually offer some of the sample interview questions that they're going to ask you. So if you do a little bit of research and go to a college's website, you can find some of this info.
So as you sat across the desk or the lunch table, the hamburger stand, whatever it was where you conducted these interviews for Georgetown, and you talked to these young people who are prospective Georgetown students, what made your ears perk up? What got your interest? What kinds of comments or pieces of conversation?
Authenticity. I think people being honest about who they were and about their passions, you know, and they weren't just saying stuff to me to impress me. Like, you know, I got A's in this and this and this course. You know what? I have a weird hobby that I like to pursue. One student was telling me about how he likes to collect gemstones, and he went on for 20 minutes about how important these stones were, how it provided him with a certain kind of space in his life.
And what did that tell you, besides the fact that there are gemstones?
He pursued learning for learning's sake. He was intellectually driven. He wasn't just driven by getting into a good school or getting grades. And that is something I think that every college, especially competitive colleges, are looking for in applicants.
Let's talk about the application process. Lee, you say that before application process begins, you should have 6 to 8 schools on your final list of possible options, 2 sure thing schools, 2 to 3 target schools where you are solidly in their range, and 2 or 3 reach schools, schools that you'd love to attend but that only accept 20% of their applicants. You're looking puzzled at me like,
apparently I did. I don't usually think of myself as being that rigid in having, you know, 6 to 8 schools on a student's list. I will say many of my students apply to more than 6 to 8, and a few apply to fewer than that.
That's an expensive process.
It can be.
Should you really narrow it down to something that's reasonably affordable?
I don't think it's relative to the cost of college. The application piece is less expensive, and if you're talking about a difference between getting $10,000 or $20,000 a year, that might offset the cost, I think you need to look at the bigger picture.
And I think it's also important, going with what you say there, Lee, for the student safety schools. Not only is it a school that you can be admitted to, it's one, you know, that you can financially afford. Because if you can't pay for it, at the end of the day, it's not a safety school.
Right.
We're going to come back to that, because affording all of this is very, very challenging. Because these applications cost money and they take time, why not narrow your prospects? I mean, what should your criteria for choosing colleges that you actually apply to be?
There needs to be some correspondence between the average standardized test scores, the average GPAs of the incoming student body, and your academic credentials. That's a big thing. Obviously, as we mentioned before, strengths in your area of interest. Where are you willing to go to college? So geography matters as well. And some of the things you read about in college guidebooks, you know. Do you want a rah-rah type school that has a big football team, you know, with stadiums packed every Saturday? Do you want a diverse student body? Are there other certain extracurricular opportunities on campus that you want to take advantage of that are only offered at certain institutions? But, you know, as Lee was saying, you know, when you settle on a list of schools that are, you know, target reach and safeties, that really needs to be the primary concern, because you don't want to apply to 9 schools that you're not getting into.
You brought, Lee, a very thick book with you, the Best 381 Colleges, 2017 edition. There are tens of thousands of schools out there, but these are the best 381. And in that book is everything you would want to know about these schools, including how many people apply, how many people accept that application, and a myriad other, the social life, et cetera, about the schools. Can you find that kind of information out about any school Not just the 381 best schools.
You can find out a lot of information. There's a lot more detailed information in this book. By the way, this just came out today. It was released September 1st from Princeton Review. There are a lot of other guidebooks out there. I personally prefer this one because I feel that it gives a much more comprehensive view. It has it talks about good things and bad things. It has some very entertaining lists in the front about the best campus food. Is this food best campus library? Is this a library? You know, and it ranks all of the schools nationally. But certainly, there's a lot of opportunity for to find out information about other schools that aren't considered the best 381.
One of you, I think it was you, Michael, mentioned something that is. I guess it's a relatively new invention. It was not familiar to me, and I knew nothing about it when I was applying to colleges. And that's the Common Application and also the Common App essay. Talk about that. What is that?
Yeah, so the Common Application has been around for quite some time, but In the past few years, though, it's become increasingly more important for students because there's over 700 colleges who are members of the Common App now. Schools like UNC Chapel Hill, NC State, Davidson, Duke, UNC Wilmington, UNC Asheville. There's a lot here within our own state. So students can fill out one generic application. It goes to each school. There's a main Common App essay. It's about 650 words or less.
Does it live in the cloud? Is that where it lives?
It lives online, correct. So they have a student, a Common App account they'll create. They'll put all their colleges on there that they want to apply to. And then inside of that, there's supplemental questions and maybe some supplemental essays for each college if they require that. So they'll fill out everything there. It just streamlines the process for students. Instead of having, you know, maybe 8 or 9 different applications on various platforms, they can submit up to, you know, as many applications as they want on the Common Application.
And where do you find out if the college that you're interested in or the colleges that you're interested in are participating?
Sure. Well, each institution's website, admissions website, they're going to indicate whether or not they have the Common App. Some schools are Common App only. So the only way you can apply to that school is by the Common App. But also on the Common App website, they have a list of member institutions and they list all of those schools there.
Now, I want to get back to something you were talking about because people may not be familiarly with regular decision, early action, restrictive early action. I mean, the list goes on, and it's mind-boggling. Mm-hmm. Let's take that apart a little bit. Which one of these early or regular decisions that you have to make is binding and which is not?
Okay.
And what does that mean?
Sure. So early decision is binding. It means you are only entitled to apply to one college. Typically, the deadline is November 1st. And if you are accepted—
Isn't that risky to apply just to one college? Because they might accept you, and if they do, you're going?
If it's a school you really, really want to go to, the benefits are that you are notified earlier before, typically by December 15th, and the process is over, which is a very big perk for a lot of students.
So should you do that in your junior or your senior
year? No. You apply in the fall of your senior year.
Okay.
And so it would be a November 1st deadline, December 1st notification. There's a perk in the sense that you notified earlier, but also for many schools, there's a big boost in the acceptance rate. So go ahead.
Why is it binding? How can it be binding? I mean, you're 18 years old. You can't sign a contract.
Well, you do sign something and your parents sign something and it is binding.
And you can't get out of it. There's no way to get out.
The only way, and the colleges might dispute this, is if the family says that I have not received sufficient financial aid to go.
And that can be very difficult to do.
Exactly.
So it is not
something that you do lightly. You do not apply early decision lightly.
Right. There's a difference between not wanting to pay and not being able to pay. And there are a lot of students that try to get out of their early decision agreement because they don't want to pay, but it's very different than not being able to pay.
I want to explore this early action, restricted early action and the risks and rewards of all this, but we have to take a break. We'll come back and do that. And there's so much more territory to cover here. I don't know how we're going to get through it all, but we'll try. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and UNC-TV's Summerfest featuring North Carolina Night with the best of our state, NC Now, and North Carolina Weekend. Tonight, starting at 7:30, information at unctv.org/specials. Donald Trump lays out a plan for immigration after a meeting with Mexico's president Enrique Peña Nieto. An update on the Republican presidential nominee's proposals on immigration, illegal drugs, and trade coming up in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock on the Diane Rehm Show. I'll bet you have a lot of questions about getting your child ready for college, or maybe you're playing hooky today and you are the person heading to college and you have some questions. Reach us at WFAE.org. Charlotte Talks at WFAE.org. Search for WFAE on Facebook or get us through Twitter at Charlotte Talks. We're coming right back.
Ron Law of Theater Charlotte, a WFAE underwriter.
We have an educated audience. WFAE has an educated audience. I know that our relationship with WFAE is working because I hear people that are in the shows come up with a great deal of pride and say, I heard the spot on WFAE.
For more information, email underwriting at WFAE.org.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about getting into college, the whole process for rising juniors and seniors with Lee Bierer, Countdown to College columnist nationally and an independent college counselor, and Andrew Belasco and Michael Trevette, who are co-founders of College Transitions. Let's go back to this regular decision, early decision, and the binding nature of one of those. And this really is a serious thing. It really causes serious problems if you back out. And you had an example in the break, Andrew, of a student that was accepted at a Northeastern school.
At NYU.
And then said, no, can't find the money, don't have the money. And they said, yes, you do. And they wouldn't let him out.
That's right. The institution asked for the parents' financial records, statements on savings, assets, income, and at the end of the day determined that the student could afford.
So even if they go and drop out, or even if they say, I don't care what you say, I'm not coming, and they wait a year and start applying to other schools, NYU could, if they wanted to, tell the other schools that they reneged on their agreement, and that would look very bad for you.
They could, but it most likely would only impact that admission cycle. So if you do back out of an early decision agreement, you could still apply the following.
So this is serious stuff. Don't take it lightly. What is the difference between early action and restrictive early action?
So restrictive early action is where you can apply to that college. Well, actually, there are a variety of plans. We don't need to make it more complicated than it is. But you can apply to that college early action, but you're not allowed to apply to another college early decision.
This is so complicated.
Yeah. Yeah.
Is there a good place to go that people can understand, read and understand this?
Not to toot our own horn, but on the section of our website, collegetransitions.com, there is something called the Dataverse. And on that page, we have information regarding early action and early decision policies of students.
There are risks and rewards to all of these. Is it just that you want to know, you just want to get the matter out of the way and settled? Is that why you would do early decision or early action? Or is there something else to this?
And depending on the school, there's a very large increase at some schools in the acceptance rate for early decision. So last year, and again, I can look up in the brand new book, but last year Duke went from 13% acceptance rate regular decision to 26% acceptance rate if you applied early decision, so double.
So now we're going to start the lightning round, which I don't usually do until 5 minutes to the top of the hour, but we have so much to get through. Very quick answers. You talk about identifying colleges that are good fits. What does that mean? How do you know what a good fit for you is? You're 17 years old.
Something that's affordable.
Mm-hmm. Well, okay.
That aligns with your interests and has strengths in areas that you want to pursue.
Yeah, something you can financially afford. Is there merit aid they're offering? Extracurricular activities, location, all those different kinds of things.
And what it feels like if you're there?
I mean, we tell students, don't feel you need to break the bank to go visit every college campus you're interested in. You can do that later in the process. But get online, find out as much about the college as you can, use your counselors. That's what we're here for. So, you know, just try to evaluate the school as best you can.
Can high school counselors do this for you too? I mean, are they equipped to do some of this? Not all of it, perhaps, but are they equipped to help you make these decisions?
I think some are. I think many are unfortunately overwhelmed with discipline issues, with testing issues, with a variety of other assignments. And unfortunately, I think they would love to help the students, but unfortunately, I don't think they generally have the time.
If you're planning on getting a graduate degree, you know you want to be X, and you're planning on getting a graduate degree because that really is going to help you in your future employment, should you pick your undergraduate school based on that?
You should, and affordability should be a primary concern. So as I mentioned earlier in the show, it matters less where you go and more what you do while there. So if you have an outstanding GPA, high MCAT scores, high LSAT scores, that's going to be more
important. If you can't afford the college that your heart is set on, should you even apply?
I think it's worth it to apply, but you also need to have schools that you're applying to that, again, financially it makes sense for you and your family.
Is there financial aid available to everyone? I mean, everyone. If you really want to go and you they want yeah. you, they've accepted you, and you can't afford it, is there financial aid to be found?
There's two basic kinds of aid. There's merit-based aid based on your talents, on scholarship and other talents, and there's need-based aid. And so so even a family that can fully afford to pay full freight still has the opportunity to receive merit-based aid.
Yeah.
Christina emails, we were dismayed to learn that a lot of college financial aid was based on class rank. Do schools consider the competitiveness of the high school in their admissions decisions?
When awarding merit-based aid, so aid given to students on the basis of their accomplishments either inside or outside the classroom, if it's need-based aid, no. That's solely determined on the basis of your income level and your assets.
If you have if you've been accepted at a college and you have applied for and haven't found financial aid at all, or you haven't found sufficient financial aid, should you pass? Should you cross that off your list and move on? Or should you be willing to work in addition to your college financial aid? Or take on student debt?
Yeah, I mean, obviously there's a lot of discussion about student debt. It's arguably the best kind of debt you can have. Having said that, I don't think it's worth it to necessarily break the bank to go to a certain college. Again, I think finances need to be part of this discussion for every family and what makes sense for you coming out of college. How much debt are you going to have? What are you majoring in? What is your plan? You got to have a plan. You know, what do you plan to do after this undergraduate degree? Are you going to go into the workforce for a few years? Do you plan to go straight into a postgraduate program? So these are serious discussions that families need to have well before the application process.
Because of all the horror stories we've heard about student loans and the mountains of debt that either the student or the parents or the combination of the two have when they leave, should you gauge the mountain of debt that you're going to come out of college with against prospective income in the field of your choice?
Sure, absolutely. And that's why it's, you know, you have to consider not just the costs, but what are you getting for your money? Mm-hmm. You know, what do these schools do in terms of helping you land a job, helping you go to an elite graduate school? You know, learning about financial aid and costs is important, but just as important is learning about what colleges can actually do for you.
Should parents feel guilty if they cannot afford the college their child wants to go to? Their heart, since they were 7 years old, they've wanted to go to Berkeley. Run. Should you feel guilty about not being able to afford to do that for them?
I don't think so. I think it's life's lessons. I think I think you're teaching a better lesson to say, you know what, we're living within our means. This is what we can manage. I'm sorry. Perhaps you can go there for graduate school if you do particularly well and get some grants, but I think all of us lean to be financially responsible.
Yeah.
I will share with you a personal anecdote. My nephew is going to Ohio State, and he wanted to go to the University of Maryland, which is my school, and that's why he wanted to go. And they went down, they looked at the campus, and he loved it, and he wanted to go there because it was near Washington, D.C., et cetera, blah, blah, blah. Then they went to Ohio State, and he liked it. It was okay, you know, but he really had his heart set on being a Terrapin. his degree is going to require a graduate degree. And my father said, my brother said, I will, he's kind of like my father now, isn't he? my brother said, I will pay for your undergraduate degree if you want to go to one of these schools. But if you want to go to graduate school, I'm only going to pay for it if you go to Ohio State, because they want you more than Maryland, and they're going to give you money. Yeah. So you make the decision. And I said, wow. And he said, no, he has to grow up. So he has to make this decision. Is that a good way to handle it?
I think so. I've had that scenario repeated in my office multiple times. We'll pay for in-state tuition. Anything above that, you're on your own, loans, whatever it might be. And I think every family's financial situation is obviously different, and they have to do what's right for them. I've had families say, you know, we'll move and sell the house and put everything towards your education. I don't think that's necessarily a great way to operate, but families do it.
So we've talked about the ACTs and the SATs, but now there are colleges that no longer require these tests. What takes their place?
So the rigor of one's grade, the rigor of one's courses, their grades, their extracurricular profile. So going test optional shouldn't just be a matter of whether or not your test scores are lower than average or about average. If you're not doing well in other things that can compensate for the fact that you haven't submitted test scores, then you shouldn't be going test optional.
And these test optional schools, it's said that they help. The reason the schools are doing this, I'm told, is because it makes them more diverse. It gets different kinds of applicants in there. Does that work out in the end? Because some people have said that really what it does is allow them to get more applicants into the front door so that they will appear to be more selective.
My colleagues and I worked on this exact study, and we essentially proved through rigorous research methods that, in fact, test optional policies do not improve the diversity of participating colleges. What they do is they increase applications and increase perceived selectivity because they artificially boost the average standardized test score of those institutions who adopt these policies. So if I'm a test optional school, my lowest scores are obviously not submitting their results. So that, in effect, makes my institution's test scores higher.
And what do SATs and ACTs tell you about that person? What does it tell a college about you? Does it tell you that you have a propensity to be educable? Does it show off the fact that you've done well in high school, that you've applied yourself? What do they show them?
It's supposed to be a predictor of academic success. It's looked at as if, how well did you do here? Are you prepared to do well at our institution? And, of course, there are different scores, and the higher institutions, the more selective institutions are looking for the higher scores. But, you know, there's a lot of controversy about exactly what they do demonstrate, and that there are, in fact, a lot of really strong students who are just lousy test takers. And so for those kids, a test optional school might really be effective.
Carrie on Twitter writes, how important is it to know a school's student retention rate when picking a college? Yeah. These are the people that come back after their freshman year, right?
Yeah, that's right. That can be very important. I mean, it can certainly tell you about the selectivity of the university, how competitive they are, but also what the campus climate would be like. Is it a school where students are there for a short period of time, then they're looking to transfer? Is it a place where students are just generally not successful due to lack of resources from the institution? So it can tell you a lot. I think it's very important.
Mm. So if you find a school that you like and you discover that their retention rate is not good, walk away?
You have to compare apples to apples, I think. Yeah. So there are schools, for instance, Harvard is always going to have a very high retention rate because of the students they attract. So inputs are an important thing to consider here as well. It's different than UNC Charlotte, where a lot of students are entering with different set of circumstances. Maybe they're non-traditional students, adult students that have a lot of other competing obligations. And for that reason alone, UNCC might have a lower retention rate. It's not necessarily that UNCC is not doing as good of a job trying to keep those students on campus. It's just the Harvard students are more privileged.
Let's talk about the dreaded essay. Its construction, its topic, its role in the process. In these essays, Lee, are colleges looking for how you write, how you think, what you think, and have possibly acted upon, how creative you are. What are they looking for in these essays?
Yes, 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 and yes. They're looking for all these things. The essay is the sort of final piece of the puzzle where the student has total control, right? So So at a certain point, they're doing the application. The test scores are what they are. The GPA is what it is, the rank in class, et cetera, et cetera. And the activities are even, you're where you're at. But the essay is where the student gets to show how they think, what they think about, what quirks they might have, how they set themselves apart from other applicants. Students, if they present, they look at themselves as not terribly different on paper, and then the essay is a way for them to differentiate themselves.
In a recent article you wrote about tackling those essays, you gave a couple of examples of questions that they have that launched the essays. Evaluate an experience, achievement, or risk you've taken and describe its effect on you. Indicate a person who's had significant influence on you and describe that influence. Given your background, describe an experience that illustrated what you would bring to the diversity in a college community. And one that you gave me in the break, it's not easy being green. Discuss.
Or what is square one at University of Chicago this year? What is square one, and can you actually go back to it? They want to see how you think. What are you thinking about? What is going on inside your brain, inside your heart?
And if you're the young person tasked with writing this essay, no matter what the question is, you're going to be tempted, it would seem to me, to try to come off as incredibly smart. Is that wise?
Not necessarily. It shouldn't necessarily. You don't have to come up with anything extraordinary. Your essay can be about something very, very ordinary that you just, you know, feel strongly about. The best essay I read last year focused on an ordinary daily routine, a walk to school, actually, and how that walk provided this young woman a sense of stability in a set of what was really just ever-changing set of circumstances for her. And through this essay, you really got to see that how she approached the world, how she approached, you know, her relationships with others. That's what's really important.
Is that why you say, Lee, be authentic?
Absolutely.
You say that make sure it doesn't sound like it was written by a 45-year-old lawyer, but by a student. When you go to these college visits, and we only have 30 seconds left, what should you be looking for as you go to the campus?
I think there's a lot. We have a short amount of time, but find out if it's the right fit for you. Talk to students, talk to faculty, get as much info as you can while you're there.
And how can you stand out? How do you make yourself stand out?
Be yourself.
Really, just be yourself.
Be yourself, yeah.
Take time with the essay.
And one of you writes, I think, Andrew, in your book you say, keep mom and dad on a leash when it comes to interacting with the admissions office.
That's right. Admissions office doesn't want to hear from you, not your parents. It should be about you. That's the application.
I hope you're hearing this, helicopter parents. Wow. Andrew Belasco and Michael Trevett are co-founders of College Transitions, and Andrew Belasco is co-author of The Enlightened College Applicant, Lee Bearer, independent college counselor, author of The Countdown to College, in syndicated column in newspapers, including The Observer.